I'm ready, already. On Wednesday, I leave for a few days to go to Spirit Rock to teach a four-night, five-night retreat. And one of the probably most common questions near the end of a retreat from people who go on these meditation retreats is, how do I bring this practice into my daily life? How do I bring this practice, bring the retreat into my daily life, or integrate the practice in my life, or something? Somehow bridge the practice from being on retreat into daily life. And what prompts that question often is, it's a very sincere question, that something very satisfying is happening on retreat, some deep sense of intimacy, some deep sense of presence, of calm, of well-being. There's a variety of things people might describe it, because there's a variety of ways people experience the benefits of being on retreat. And somehow people would like to have that continue into their daily life, or after the retreat. So the question is, so one of the questions then is, how do you do Buddhist practice outside of meditation? We do a lot of meditations, and we're kind of focal points of our center here. But what do you do outside of meditation, outside of retreat? For some people, in a sense, the answer to that question is nothing. And what their focus is, and let me get back to the meditation cushion. Let me get back on retreat. That's where it's really at. That's where the spiritual life really is. And other people realize that they can't always be meditating, can't always be on retreat, and so they want to find out, is there a Buddhist practice in daily life? When I went to practice at Tassajara, the Zen monastery there, we did a lot of Zen meditation, Zazen. And I was a somewhat young, somewhat idealistic Zen student. And for me, what was important was meditation. And all the wonderful promise of Zen, I placed in meditation. That's where it was at. That's where the real practice was. That's where real progress and benefits, and that's where the real thing was. Whatever I was going to get from Zen is going to happen in meditation. And so one of the things that happens often, what happened, probably still does, in the Zen monastery, was you'd spend a lot of your time, not as much as a Vipassana retreat, but you might spend 5 hours a day meditating in the meditation hall. And you might have the experience of feeling, oh, it's going really well. Occasionally it might happen this way. It's going really well. And you might even feel that, oh, I know I'm on the brink of enlightenment, or the brink of something wonderful is going to happen. This is it. The concentration is really going. I've been working for a long time to get concentrated. I'm finally concentrated. This is great. I finally have all this insight or clarity or just something. You're sitting there. And then someone comes along and taps you on the shoulder. And they say, excuse me, you get a phone call. and someone says, we need you right now, in the kitchen to peel the carrots or to help in the kitchen. And then, but you don't realize, you don't understand. My meditation, it's going so well right now. I'm on the brink of full, perfect enlightenment. And it doesn't compare to the importance of, peeling carrots. Yeah, carrots. There's no spirituality in carrots, right? I mean, this is where it's at, just sitting here. And but in the Zen monastery, saying that, doesn't work. Doesn't cut the mustard. You can't hold up the great progress in meditation against the need of the kitchen. So you have to let go of what's happening in meditation and go down to the kitchen. And it seemed it was you know see And it happened regularly that they would call and say, you can't be sitting here listening to Dharma talks because something really important is happening, and you have to come. You know, the kids need you right now, or you know, work needs you right now, or something needs you. And it seemed like it was unerring that somehow I'd be sitting there meditating and like, this is it, right, or something important, and I get that tap on the shoulder. And then I'd been at the monastery about 9 months, so I was still relatively new to it all. And I was really gung-ho. I love meditation, and during the summer at Tassajara, you don't do a lot of meditation. You take care of this summer season, which is kind of like a guest season. They have like a hotel or a resort almost, and so take care of all the guests and stuff. And what I did during the summer was I washed dishes. I had my official Zen certificate in dishwashing. I did a lot of dishes. It was okay. I was into doing the dishes, but I was looking forward to the fall when we went back into intensive retreat mode. And we were going to go back into doing a lot of meditation. And so, you know, the fall came. It was the practice period, the retreat time. And I didn't get the tap on the shoulder. Rather, the director came over to me and said, for the next 3 months, during this next retreat time, you know, this precious time to be on retreat and really meditate a lot, really get serious about my Zen practice after washing dishes all summer, we need you for the next 3 months to work in the kitchen. And that's where we need you. And, you know, in the kitchen, you get to meditate a little bit when you're in the kitchen, but mostly you work in the kitchen. And you work in the kitchen. And you work in the kitchen. And, you know, but, you know, I'm a new student. You know, I'm here. You know, it's fine for someone who's been at the monastery for 3 or 4 years. They've done all their serious Zen training. They got meditation down. But I'm new. I'm gung-ho. And this is my time to meditate. So, what's the solution? The solution is not to hold on to meditation as the be-all and end-all of Buddhist practice. Maybe working in the kitchen is as important or as valuable a form of practice as sitting on the cushion. Maybe the letting go of the attachment to meditation, or letting go of how wonderful meditation is going or how meaningful it is the real training. Rather than the training being getting into a good meditation state, it's the letting go of the clinging to it, which is a very important training. So here I'm offering two things. One was learning to let go, learning that there's tremendous value in letting go. And in fact, and often in meditation practice, the deeper benefits of meditation come from having let go and let go and let go. And it's kind of a paradox that at some point meditators are holding on, clinging to meditation, clinging to letting go. To paraphrase an ancient Buddhist saying, something like, this is a big paraphrase, actually a rewording of it, but letting go is the ultimate medicine. But the person who clings to letting go, there's no cure. There's no medicine for that person. Anyway, so part of the training is to let go. And I learned how, I learned kind of somewhat slowly at first, but I learned that ability to let go to what I was holding on to, what my agenda is, what I was trying to do, what I thought was important. Letting go to a certain way, in a certain kind of way, letting go to kind of my ideal of what spiritual life was about. That letting go was a profound act. A liberating act, freeing act, that got me in touch with something that was much more profound than particular states that I could attain and reach in meditation practice. And it was actually a very effective part of the training in the monastery to be interrupted that way and say, oh, you know, please, you know, you can't go and meditate right now. You have to go and, you know, oh, the sewers are backing up. and we need someone to go back up the sewers. Someone to clean them out. Or all kinds of things happen. There's always something, you know, going wrong in the monastery. And so, so you have to kind of go do that. And so so that was one thing, was learning the process of letting go. And the other process was the process of discovering how to make what you were doing the Buddhist practice. And that was, you know, for me, was also kind of something I had to learn. So, for example, I was assigned to that kitchen for 3 months instead of meditating. And I didn't particularly want to be in the kitchen. You know, that's not where... I didn't understand that that was much spiritual value. And so it was just there I was in the kitchen, and it was just me and the carrots. And I could, you know, and I, by that time I had a sense that one of the ways I understood my Zen training was it was a part how to kind of get myself completely participating, really present for what I was doing, whatever I was doing, not just present, but actually a little higher kind of demand. How can I participate fully in whatever activity I was doing? So how could I participate with chopping the carrot? How can I really be there for that? And it was interesting to explore that because sometimes I didn't want to be there. And sometimes my body actually turned facing the door. You know, let's get out of here. And you know, part of my body just wasn't in there, kind of like, you know, chopping like this. But you know, I would notice that, and then I would bring my body back and just put both feet there, and my torso and my hands, and just be, okay, just you and me, carrot. And so there I'd be, you know, and it was a great training to let go of all these distractions, all the hindrances. It turned out that all the things that come up in meditation practice in the mind came up between me and the carrot. And all the hindrances we have to deal with in mindfulness, in the meditation practice, and you know, the ability to get concentrated, pay attention, be mindful, the ability to let go. One of the valuable things in mindfulness practice is not to get excessively concentrated, so you get to lose a touch of your context of what's going on. And chopping a carrot in the kitchen with other cooks walking around and doing their thing, you have to not only focus on what you're doing, but you have to also have kind of a panoramic attention to what's going on around you, what the context was. And so it was a whole training to learn, you know. And eventually I learned to love chopping vegetables. And I got to see that chopping the vegetables made me very, very present. And actually, one of the beautiful things I noticed after a while was I would leave the kitchen. Sometimes it was because, you know, sometimes it was part of the schedule, but it was to work in the kitchen for a period of time and then go to join the others up in the meditation hall to meditate. And I would go up and I'd be really present for my meditation. I'd show up and I'd be really concentrated and present and engaged. And there I was, just here. And I was just there in the hall because I'd learned eventually just be there with the carrots. Isn't that nice? So I learned something about meditation by being with those vegetables in the kitchen. Or washing the pots in the kitchen, or whatever it had to be doing in the kitchen. But the kitchen itself offered all kinds of challenges. One of the challenges was that I loved was that at like maybe lunch was served up at 12:30. In the Zen monastery, it's basically a choreographed life. Like everything's kind of, you know, you're kind of told where you're often, you know, where you show up at what time. It's very, very, very orchestrated. Particular time to show up, and there was exactly a particular time, not only for lunch, but when lunch was served in the meditation hall. So you had to kind of, and there were servers who would serve the food, and they'd have to step into the meditation hall at a particular minute, particular moment when the bell rang, bong, at a particular time. And it was, you know, it wasn't kind of like, say, oh, you know, dinner's not quite ready yet, and lunch's not quite ready, you know, and just hang out and wait, it'll be done soon, or, you know, it's like, you know, it's like a play, right? In a play, you know, you can't, you know, if you don't have your dress on yet, you don't say, you yell up from the stage, I'll be there soon. Just freeze. So, you know, everything, you know, is choreographed. So maybe lunch was at 12:30. And we'd be working in the kitchen really hard to get that lunch ready. And sometimes it was a little bit hard to get it, you know. So, the other trick, especially in the winter, was that you didn't want to make it too far early in advance because it was really cold. In the meditation hall, there was no heating. It was really cold up there in the Sahara in the mountains. And so the food had to be kept warm. So you had to kind of make it. So anyway, the timing was really important. So then at 12:15, lunch is supposed to be served up at 12:30. At 12:15, they ring a bell in the kitchen. And all the kitchen workers had to stop what they were doing and go over to the little kitchen altar and stand around the kitchen altar and chant the Heart Sutra. Do this chanting. And yet, I can't tell you how many times they rang that bell and I went, I can't. I can't. I have to be ready. You guys do it. I'm going to keep stirring the soup or something, you know. You know, we don't have time for that, you know. We're up against the deadline here. But that didn't cut it, you know. You couldn't say that it was like a religious thing. You had to do that chanting. And so, you know, and I got, you know, and I can't think of any time where stopping to do the chanting kept us from serving the meal on time. But I can remember many times where I thought it wouldn't. So again, it was this idea, this has to be a certain way, it has to, you know, all kinds of ideas. I had to learn to let go in the kitchen as well. So that process of having a task to do, a task that had a deadline, a task that had consequence if you didn't do it right, was also to begin holding that ideal lightly, not to cling to that too tightly, and learn to let go. The chanting 15 minutes before was actually, for me, a great training in letting go. And then, so it turned out that after those 3 months in the kitchen, I really started to like working in the kitchen a lot. I really loved it in there. You know, got chopping and me and the carrots. And I kind of didn't really, even though I was kind of aware of other people in the kitchen, where they were standing, what was going on and all that, I was mostly kind of absorbed in, I was mostly kind of a prep person. And I would just do this chopping, chopping, chopping. I love chopping. Give me 5 gallons of onions. I just love it. And I get really good at it, you know, and just absorbed in it. And I'm just so happy after, you know, not initially, but eventually in the kitchen. So what happens in a Zen monastery is that if you're really happy with what you're doing, you get the equivalent of that tap on the shoulder. And you know, you're on to the next thing. And one of the great things that I discovered about the Zen monastery was you could have more careers in a Zen monastery than most people can have in a lifetime. You know, you're the baker or the cook or you're the accountant or you're the you're the plumber, or you know, you do all kinds of different jobs, you know, three months at a time or 6 months at a time. And it's great to do a whole new activity. Someone's never been done kind of utility work, you know, carpentry work, is suddenly sent up to the shop to be head of the shop. There's, you know, so suddenly have to, you know, discover that. So the 3 months in the kitchen, I was made kind of like the kitchen manager. Not the head cook, but kind of like the person who managed the kind of day-to-day activities of the kitchen. And so I didn't spend so much time chopping all the time, you know, just me and the carrots. I had to kind of watch what everybody else was doing and manage all these people. And I discovered that the kitchen was different than what I thought it was. Not the kitchen, but the kitchen crew. I thought everyone was happy. And it turned out that actually most people in the kitchen were unhappy, and for a variety of reasons. And for one reason is that a intensive Buddhist training environment tends to highlight people's hindrances, it tends to highlight people's hang-ups, neuroses, psychoses, you know, the kind of hang-ups of the mind. And that's kind of what they're designed to do, is to show that so you can work with them and purify them. And it's very intense, there's no escape, you can't get away from it, you can't get away from yourself really in the kind of way you could in daily life, you go to the movies or something. And there's no movies in the monastery. And the kitchen is kind of known as a pressure cooker, and more than actually the meditation at other times. So suddenly I was the manager for all these people who are under pressure. And so I had to learn all kinds of people skills. I had to learn how to manage people. And I remember once telling one of the people there, I asked her if she could please cut the cucumbers a little bit smaller. Because, again, everything's choreographed, you know, in a particular way. Well, the Zen monks, Zen practitioners have to, one of the dishes for lunch has to be eaten in a bowl that's about this size, really small. And so the vegetables can't be cut really big if they're going to fit in that little thing, right? So the idea was the carrots, you know, in order to get enough carrots to fit properly in this little bowl, they have to be sliced a little bit smaller. So I said, can you please, very kindly, I said, you know, can you please make them a little bit smaller? And she burst into tears. Another time, this guy who was on my crew with me, suddenly left the kitchen, came back a little bit later, and he cooled down and he said, Gil, if you weren't so sincere, I'd punch you out. It's an intense place. Yeah, what? This is a Buddhist monastery and peace and love reigns, you know, and everyone gets along and harmony and, you know, not in the kitchen. But so I had to learn a lot, and what happens to me is I learned a lot about myself in that process. And one of the things I learned about myself, which was actually, I was slow to learn, but I learned it because I was in so much pain around it. Sometimes it's only by suffering enough that you can really stop and really see what's going on. And eventually what I found was that I was really driven very powerfully. I was hooked, caught by this idea that I wanted everyone to like me. Now, it's fine to want people to like you. You can hold that lightly and kind of do a little bit. But it's also possible to be neurotic about wanting people to like you. And I just was neurotic. You know, it was really important that everyone liked me, and I was afraid if people didn't like me. And so I was trying so hard to get all the fellow kitchen crew to like me. But in that pressure cooker, people crying, if you say, just, you know, can you please cut the carrot, the, you know, cucumbers a little bit smaller, it wasn't so easy. And so eventually I got to see, boy, I'm really driven, really controlled by this desire to try to make everyone like me all the time. And then I went and talked to some of the teachers about it, and kind of, that just talking about it with someone helped me. I admit it to myself even more. And then eventually I was able to slowly let go of that grip and loosen up on this need for people to like me all the time, and, you know, lighten up about it. And that was really liberating, really helpful for me, because I was so driven by that. Another thing I learned in the kitchen was, so I worked in the kitchen then for 6 months, and then my job as a kitchen manager was extended for 6 more months. But now it was kind of through the summer season where the kitchen got a lot more busy. They were feeding something like 150 people a day sometimes, and there were 6 meals a day to cook, 2 breakfasts and 2 lunches and 2 dinners, and one for the students and another for the guests. The guest was really fancy, and it was a big production. There was a baker who baked full-time. There was, you know, all these big crew of people, and I was managing them all. A lot of people who were relatively new cooks. And by that time, I'd been in the kitchen for 6 months, and I'd gotten somewhat proficient at a variety of cooking things. And I could do a lot of things in the kitchen by that time twice as fast as many of the people in my crew. So it was very inefficient for me to let other people do things. So I would race around doing, you know, I was trying to do everything, you know, and it took me about 3 or 4 months to realize that the whole kitchen ran better if I didn't do anything except go around the kitchen and make sure that everybody else was happy. Even though they were slower, the whole system worked better. I would go around and I was going to see, oh, you're chopping carrots. Can I go to the walk-in and get more carrots for you? You look like you're running low. Oh, can I wash your pot for you? Or, you know, do you need anything? Or can I explain this? So just kind of just check in and kind of, and everything worked a lot better. And that was a slow lesson. because I was kind of attached to doing it, you know, being in charge and, you know, a certain kind of charge. You know, I was going to be the one who's going to make everything, you know, I thought I was going to fix everything, make everything go right by doing all the work myself. And they're giving up on the work, in a sense, and just managing was a hard lesson for me. So what I'm trying to convey here this evening is that I learned a lot in the monastery, not from doing meditation. I learned it from the kind of things that many of us do in a normal life. Cooking, washing pots and dishes, interacting with other people and seeing what happens in the interaction. I learned a lot from, at times, from the inability to actually follow through on what I thought was the real thing, meditation. And some of you probably would like to meditate. Some of you probably do meditate every day. Some of you would like to and haven't gotten the discipline yet to do it. And some of you maybe have the discipline to do it, but life interferes periodically. Something happens. And all your good intentions are there to get up in the morning and sit. Maybe you do get the phone call from someone at work or someplace and something happens and you can't do it. So you could be grumpy and say, "Oh my, they're taking me away from my real spiritual practice." Or you can say, "Well, this is your spiritual practice now. Spiritual practice is to discover the beauty or the value in letting go, not holding on, even to spirituality, or what you think is spirituality." And the Buddhist path is found. Okay, since life is asking me to do something different than what I thought I should be doing, let me engage in this wholeheartedly and see if I can make a path out of this, or discover how to be awake, how to be present, how to be engaged. Can I discover how to let go of all the different forces in the mind? First, can I learn to see them, and then I can let go of them? Can I see the forces in the mind of distraction, of fear, of hate, of expectation, of agendas? Can I see all the things that are operating that interfere with making this one activity that I'm doing now the activity which is the right place for me to do? My meditation practice, you know, this is where reality, this is where liberation, this is where freedom, this is where the Dharma is going to be revealed. This here, you know, going down and getting the oil change, changing the oil in my car myself, or standing there in the oil change place and waiting for them to finish. What do you think of that? You know, standing there in that oil place, and, right? You know, the Buddhist texts don't say that that's the place where you discover Buddhism. But so the question is, can you kind of find it there? And if you can't find it there, then you don't find it there. So you could say, it could be self-fulfilling prophecy where you say, Buddhist practice cannot be discovered in daily life. Well, someone said today to me, maybe I shouldn't say this, maybe I shouldn't repeat this.
Too late.
It's a kind of variation of something I say about meditation. The person said, you can't win the lottery unless you play the lottery. So I've said sometimes, you know, that mindfulness doesn't work unless you do it. But see, you're not going to find the spiritual value, the practice value of daily life unless you try to find it. If you say it's not going to be found there, don't try, you're not going to find it. And the challenge, the offer, the suggestion is that you can discover all the depth in daily life that you can find on the cushion. In some ways, it might be harder to discover a lot of it. There's more distractions, there's all kinds of things getting in the way. But on the other hand, it might actually be richer and more valuable. There might be more ways in which you're challenged and have a chance to look at yourself if you take on your daily life. Now, I know I've met people who have said that, "Oh, my whole life is spiritual practice." And there's something very profound about seeing that. And I've seen some people take that attitude, and it's just an excuse not to do any spiritual practice. And they're not really engaged. But to kind of do whatever is going on for you, since you're doing it, you do it with intentionality, or do it with, this is the thing that I'm doing. This is where I can discover my practice. if you're spending time kind of looking at your watch and kind of I can't wait until I get to the real thing. You know, the real thing, you know, get yourself to the monastery. Well, the danger then is you'll get yourself to the monastery, and then you'll feel this finger on your shoulder. And because maybe someone in the monastery has picked up that, you know, that you have a problem being attached to the meditation, you know, and so you need to please come here. And practicing in daily life. A lot of it has to do with a choice you make. And I think this is a really important point. A lot of it has to do with a choice that you make, that you decide that you're going to really try to make your daily life your practice. If you haven't made that choice, then I guess it's not going to work. And maybe you don't want it to make it. Maybe you don't want it to be your choice, because you want spirituality to be something different than getting under your sink when there's a drip and trying to get it in, you know, underneath there and looking up and trying to figure it all out. I mean, that's not spirituality, right? Mm-hmm. Or there's all kinds of things you can think about that you do that on the surface you think, oh, this doesn't count. This can't be. When I teach the intro class in mindfulness practice, one of the things I try to stress is that religions often have something they consider sacred. And in a sense, Buddhism also has something considered sacred. But what's most sacred in Buddhism is your awareness, when your awareness doesn't exclude anything. It's your mind or your heart when it hasn't excluded anything, when there's no outside, when everything is included inside, when there's no outside. Everything's within your mind. Everything is within your heart. Everything's within your awareness. But if you have the idea, oh, not that. I'm not supposed to pay attention to that. That's not supposed to be happening. That's not supposed to be in my awareness. Then it's not sacred, because then you have an outside. So discover a capacity to hold everything. To hold everything within your heart, or everything within in your mind. And it doesn't mean that you say yes to everything. It doesn't mean you, in a sense, condone or accept everything. But what it means is that your heart and mind doesn't contract or resist or put up walls to any experience in this world of ours. So everything is included. When everything's included, then it's sacred. And if something's excluded, then you've lost what is sacred. So to make your whole life, make your life as it is, your practice. And then to turn back to meditation practice. Meditating every day is really useful, because, among other things, meditation practice is like the salt you put in the soup to make the soup really good. So if the soup is your life, and meditation is the salt that flavors it just right, be careful you don't put too much salt in. So, was that encouraging? So, that was my hope. So I hope you'd go home and wake up, tonight or tomorrow morning, because I'm pretty sure that relatively soon something's going to come along. It's going to happen to you, which shouldn't happen. This shouldn't be happening. And some of us, are Buddhist practitioners. This shouldn't be happening. And as soon as you say that, you have an outside. Then you've lost what's sacred. And it doesn't mean you have to accept it. You might have to, do something about it. But don't have an outside. Include everything. Discover how your freedom can be found in any activity at all. and don't hold up meditation as being the only place you're going to find your freedom. If you do that, then you have an outside. So, is that enough? So, thank you very much.